Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Becker on Darren, Donick, and Chase on this Thursday morning. ESPN 102.5 The Game. We say hello to Mitch Light from The Athletic. Mitch, what's going on?
Good morning, Darren. How you doing, sir?
How's quarantine life for the
great.
Light family?
It's amazing. Couldn't be better. Four of us in the house all the time. It's amazing, Darren. Now, I would give my family, on a scale of 1 to 10, if you would have told me 2 months ago that we're going to be in the house all the time, including a college-age daughter who clearly doesn't want to be in the house and a 15-year-old son, I would have probably said we'll probably be about a 4 or 5 out of 10. But I'll give the White family a 7.8. I think
Wow.
Things are going surprisingly well.
Okay, very good. Good to hear. We're off to a good start.
Yeah, and one thing that helps, and Darren, you are not, I know your son's not old or young, but like, my kids are older, so it's like we don't have to be around them, babysit. They can do their own thing. It's the people that have the two or three kids under 5 and 6 years old. We all love our children, but we don't love them that much that we want to be around them 24 hours a day.
Boy, you're right about that. You are right, and I know plenty of those families, and you're right. I do. I think, man, oh. We have an 8-year-old, and it's been fine. But, yeah, I could not imagine the 8, 6, 4, and 2-year-old households, right? And I know those
families.
I don't
even want to think about it.
And you've done all that, right? You're not willing to. Yeah. You're not ready to go back to that.
Exactly.
The University of Tennessee said yesterday that their intentions are to have classes in the fall on campus. That now makes, I believe, 10 schools in the SEC that has said their intentions are to have classes in the fall on campus. Why do you think this news is coming out in late April, early May? Why do you think that's being put out there now?
Well, because a lot of schools, a lot of kids have to commit financially to the fall semester. You know, there's different dates where you have to send in your housing money or send in different kind of deposits and stuff like that. So I think that's a big reason. And I think schools also, there's all sorts of contingency plans. What they say publicly is what they hope to do, what they plan to do, but everyone's making contingency plans because we just don't know where we'll be. So I think it's obviously a positive sign, but I'm in the camp that I'm not positive or negative. I just admit that I don't know. And you have to admit that we just don't know, where we're going to be in a month or two.
Where is your family in the camp of a lot of people? Because your daughter, did she ended up completing the semester online?
Yeah.
Is that how that worked?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah,
at Vanderbilt.
Whatever. Start mid-March on online and finished finals last week.
Okay. So if there's been a lot of disgruntled people saying, I don't want to pay full price for classes in the fall. I don't feel like I'm getting the same education. Have you guys had those type of discussions at home? How does your daughter feel about that? And how much do you think that has weighed into some of these decisions to try to get kids back on campus? Because a lot of people are saying, I'm not paying full tuition for virtual classes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating argument. And I see the students and the parents. A big expense of being in college is actually being on campus. Housing, secure. It's not just housing and food. It's security that the school has to provide, the police force, everything about it, all the employees and stuff like that. So you know what, Darren, I'm being honest, haven't really thought about it too much. It's one of those things when we have to make a decision on it, we'll think about it some more. If Vanderbilt came to me, because my daughter's at Vanderbilt, they came to me and said, hey, we're doing classes online for the first 2 months and not reducing your tuition, of course we're going to say that's awesome. If they don't, I think we would still do what we need to do. It's not like we're going to take her out of school for, because there's only online classes for 2 months or a semester. So these are fascinating discussions, and Again, we'll have them when we need to have them, but really haven't thought about it too much yet.
Where do you think we are, since you are on college football sidelines on Saturdays, where do you think we are in the college football landscape of this upcoming fall season?
You know, that I wish I had an answer. I mean, if you told me gun to my head and I had to make a decision right now, I would say a delayed start to the season sometime in October that spills into the new year with limited fans in the stands. But again, you know, there's really smart people that are trying to make all these different plans, Darren, and they don't even know. And I know it's something we need to talk about. You guys need to talk about it, but it's unprecedented. I mean, we say that word a lot. Things are unprecedented in the sports world. This is truly unprecedented.
Yeah, look, you're right. I wouldn't want to be in those rooms trying to make those decisions, but there's a lot at stake, as we all know, and they're trying to figure it out. And they're in a unique dynamic because they're different than the pro sports, because it looks like the pro sports are trying to figure out plans moving forward and how they're going to operate with new rules and new conditions. But you've got this dynamic of, you know, student athletes, and they're not pros, and they're not getting paid, or they're getting paid with a scholarship. So it is a little bit – it's a lot trickier on their side of things, for sure.
No doubt. And, you know, there's a big camp out there that, you know, the pro athletes should be paid, and not even just the, you know, name, image, and likeness, but that they should be paid, and, you know, that these universities are trying to find ways to get them to play so the universities can get their money, the athletic departments can get their money. You know, I don't necessarily subscribe to that cynical theory. Like, I think if we can figure out a way to make it safe and play with no people in the stands, I think the athletes would want to play if they think they can be safe. You know, that's the game they love. And a lot of them, you know, for themselves professionally down the road, like if you're a rising senior or a junior, really good, you want to play football this year, so you get another year on tape and you get drafted next year. Not that you wouldn't get drafted if you're a good player, but I think if I put it this way, Darren, I'm for playing under any scenario that's safe. I know a lot of people say, well, if there's not students or if there's not people in the stands, they shouldn't play. I think if they can play, they should play.
We're talking to Mitch Light, who is writing for The Athletic. And, Mitch, we had Joe Rexroad, your colleague, on yesterday, and we were talking to him about some of the creativity that's going on with The Athletic right now. And it's allowed for some really interesting storytelling. You've got an article out there today that you wrote on the relationship between Tim Corbin and James Franklin. And I think it would be interesting not only to Vanderbilt fans, who obviously are going to want to read this, but even for others that have always followed the Southeastern Conference and looked at Vanderbilt and wondered, you know, can you win there? How do you win there? Why haven't they won there? Because that's the one thing that really has bonded Tim Corbin and James Franklin from the start, is the ability to jump in, change the culture at their respective programs, and win at a place that it's not easy to win at.
Yeah, and I mean, culture is probably one of the more overused words in sports. I was talking to Darren before, he said, you know, unprecedented is a word, you know, we use in our culture. We use a lot and overuse it, and same thing with culture. But I think with these two guys, it really has made a big difference. And you know, one of my favorite quotes in there, and both guys kind of said it, but I used Maggie Corbin's quote. Tim's wife said, you know, it was basically the first week there, and James made a beeline to Tim's office and just said, how do you do it? Tell me how you do it. And that's basically how they met each other. And they spent, Franklin spent a lot of time around the baseball program that spring semester. I talk about in the story how obviously his top priority was kind of spring practice and recruiting and setting the foundation, but he was in Corbin's office a lot around practices, knew the guys' names and all that. So, you know, they really fed off of each other. And they, you know, my first year doing sideline reporting, it was one of my first games because I took over in midseason. I remember being at the Wake Forest game late in the year. And, you know, I was Friday night at the hotel and just kind of hanging out. And you see all the coaches, they have meetings, their player meetings, positional meetings, all that stuff. And I see Tim and Maggie Corbin following the coaches into a meeting, and they have their own notebooks, like those three-ring binders. I was like, what's going on there? That, you know, you've traveled with teams. You know, there's people that go on trips, and you know, they might go out to dinner or go to the bar and all that stuff and let the team do their things. Well, Tim Corbin would travel with the team, but he would do all of the stuff that the coaches do. He would go into the meetings. He would take notes. He was just a sponge. He was trying to learn so much about coaching, and he was doing so from a guy who's 10 years younger in a different sport and a first-time head coach. So I thought that was really interesting. Not only was James Franklin trying to learn from Tim Corbin was really eager to learn from James Franklin.
Yeah, and, you know, some people, I'm sure, have done a double take if they're watching a Penn State game in a big whiteout with 100,000 fans there, a night game, and you see somebody that looks like Tim Corbin standing very close to James Franklin. It is Tim Corbin. It's really remarkable. I remember going to a College World Series game and going to my seat in the Vanderbilt section, and I looked over, and there's James Franklin sitting in the aisle right on the other side from me. But it's become so common now that you know, they've continued this years after James Franklin has left Vanderbilt.
Yeah, James Franklin's been in the College World Series all three times since he got the job at Vanderbilt. I think the first year, I don't think he went in 2011, or he might have gone, but he's been the last three times, and this is amazing. I didn't get into the story as much as I would have liked to, just for space reasons, the close relationship between Maggie and Fumi, James's wife. Fumi Franklin and the girls, their two girls, they go to Omaha when Vanderbilt's in it for the whole time. They were there for the whole 2 weeks. So it's not just James going to see, like, James can only make the finals because of his work, you know, recruiting and stuff going on. But the whole family is there. The whole family partakes in it. And you're right. Like, I think this year, College Game Day was at Ohio State for the Ohio State-Penn State game, and they take a picture on the bus, like bus one where the coaches are. They have cameras going in for James Franklin, and Tim Corbin's up there in seat one, right in the front row there. So, yeah, and I talked to our Penn State writer at the Athletic and told her I was doing the story, and she's like, yeah, he talks about Tim Corbin all the time, just impromptu in a press conference. He'll just bring up that name. And one other thing, Willie, that's interesting about the two personalities is Tim Corbin said, I go up there, I'm not a fan. I'm there to cheer on. I want my friend to do well, so I want Penn State to do well. But I'm there to learn. I'm on the sidelines. He's like, I can't sit in the stands. Like, you hear that a lot of former players and coaches. They just can't sit in the stands. They want to sit on the sideline. Well, if you watch the College World Series, James Franklin's just a fan. He's sitting there with Maggie and his family cheering him on. So I found that dynamic.
I think I high-fived him at the game I was at. This was 2014.
Yeah, you see that. Maybe that's a part of the dynamic of their personalities, too.
You know, this was another, I thought, poignant point that came out of it, is that head coaches have that common bond where they have a very tight inner circle, where there's really not a lot of people that they can really confide in and talk about some of the inner workings that are going on. That seems to be a big part of their bond.
Yeah, it's funny, Willie. You know, you do these stories, and I have an idea of what I want to ask, and some of the good stuff that comes out come from questions you ask as a reporter, and sometimes they don't. It's like James Franklin, I was just talking to him unprovoked in the middle of the sentence. He's like, you know, one thing that people don't realize is the head coach seat can be pretty lonely. And his point was just like, sort of like you just mentioned. You know, there's certain things that he has to deal with, and he has friends and head coaches, but it's not like he's going to call up the head coach at, you know, Michigan State or, you know, one of his rivals and say, talk about certain things. There's some certain things that are unique to his school, and are certain things he just doesn't want to talk about, and maybe certain things he can't talk to his assistants about or doesn't want to, or they can't relate. So that was the point there, that both these guys, different sports, but they both sit in the same chair so they can use each other as sounding boards. They understand what the other guy's going through.
What else? We hit Joe with this, but what are the brainstorming sessions been like at the Athletic? Because you've come out with some very unique ones. You've gone back through, for example, Tim Corbin's first year coaching Vanderbilt. You did one on kind of a wacky thing that happened in light of the Earl Bennett excessive celebration penalty, which all Vanderbilt fans still cringe about down in Gainesville years ago with Jay Cutler trying to lead an upset there. But you guys have certainly had to really dig deep, haven't you?
Yeah, and one thing it's done, and unfortunately it's given us the time to tell stories and spend more time on stuff like this that maybe we thought would be a good story if we ever had time. But we do these things we call them blitzes, and the themes that we do across all markets. For instance, this week is the do-over blitz, and you know, Joe Rex wrote a story yesterday on Derek Dooley and how Daniel Hood factored into that. I'm sure a lot of Tennessee fans and any fan should read that great story. But so for in Memphis today, our Memphis writer Peter Edmondson wrote something about what if Hasheem to beat, what if they could do a do over there? Remember when in 2009 and the Grizzlies took Hasheem to beat, who, you know, none of us are professional scouts, but I think we all knew that was going to be a bust. And it was one of the bigger busts in NBA history. But, you know, James Harden goes one spot later. Steph Curry goes one spot later. And then John Hollinger, who's an NBA writer for The Athletic, who used to be with the front office in the Grizzlies, actually wrote one today, too. What if they took Nikola Jokic when they could have taken that? So there's stuff like that where we have sports and media blitz. We're doing something on dominant teams, like each market. What are the 10 best teams in your market historically? So just a lot of stuff like that. What we call evergreen content, and The Athletic, we're still doing well. People are still reading. We appreciate everyone who subscribes and renews. So hopefully we'll have sports to talk about soon, but we got a staff around the country. I think we've done a really good job coming up with ideas to keep some good content on the site.
Hey, I just renewed a couple of weeks ago, so I'm enjoying the content too. So appreciate
Chase,
the hard
I love
work.
You, Chase.
Hey, I'm here for you, Mitch. Here for you, Mitch.
I loved you before, but you know, now it's just, you know, stronger.
I appreciate it. Mitch Light of The Athletic here with us, and I want to circle back to where Darren had taken things earlier in the conversation about college football and whether it comes back, because Ryan Porth and I did the 9 o'clock hour this morning and basically turned a 10 minute conversation into almost the whole hour on some comments that started with James Franklin and what he said about that. Listen, if there are schools in the Big Ten that are ready to go, they shouldn't have to wait on other schools that aren't, that, you know, their campuses aren't open, because that hurts the conference. And I said, listen, there's some coach speak there. He's looking like he's going to have a pretty decent team. And I think that those comments could be directed towards, if Ohio can't open, well, stinks for Ohio State, but Penn State's ready to go. What do you think about that? Let's just use the Big Ten. If half the Big Ten is ready to play, then should they play some games and just wait on the rest? Or is it an all or nothing deal in your mind?
That's a fascinating question, and I will answer in a second. James Franklin spoke to the media on Zoom yesterday, and that's where all the quotes from. Didn't I see a Franklin comment also that college football, this sort of contradicts what he's saying, unless I totally misread it, that as a sport, that it should be all or one, or all or none. Like, if every conference that is ready to play, he's play if they're not. So was he talking about just getting going on off-season workouts? Did you hear that other comment?
Yeah,
I guess my question.
Well, from what I heard, the part that I heard was that he had talked to another coach, and that another coach was essentially saying that it needs to be an all-or-nothing deal, and then James essentially disagreed with that, and that you hurt
okay,
the conference.
Okay, so that's interesting.
Overall,
I don't. You know what? This is a bad answer. I don't know how I feel, because I think there's really good points on both. Like, if you are, you know, even in a more rural area like Penn State is, and it's a smaller town, and there's not a lot of cases there, and you can safely get your guys together, your 100 players together. Why shouldn't you be able to? When Ohio State, Columbus is a huge city, and there's different governances coming down, so I can see his point there, but I can also see the point where the NCAA has certain regulations. There's the 20-hour rule during the season, and just there's certain limitations on practice. So I'm kind of thinking as I go here, but I would say I would be okay with if certain schools could get their act together or were allowed to, of them starting to work out while other schools in the same conference could not.
So let me throw this theory that again, this was a 10-minute conversation that became almost an hour, because like you just said, I was thinking about it, you know, while we're having the talk, and different theories popped in my head. So one thing that I threw out was, let's say that the SEC, that Greg Sankey is like, 10 of our 14 schools are open and ready to go. We can start the season. Four aren't. And then you have, let's say, four schools out of the Big Ten that they're ready to go. Well, those two conferences kind of get together and they say, hey, let's work out a schedule where your four schools can come play with us. and when the rest are ready, then we'll figure that out. But we can start Labor Day weekend and get a schedule, you know, get a schedule going. How crazy of a theory would that be?
Yeah, and I was talking to someone about this yesterday, that I think no matter what happens with the 2020 season, or if it's the 2020-2021 season, it's going to be just asterisk late, you know, whatever happened. Like, yes, you know, Ohio State won a national championship, but the Pac-12 didn't play, that this season, because the schools in California or whatever. Or so-and-so, LSU was the SEC champion, but only 10 of 14 teams participated. My thinking would be, from a conference standpoint, I think starting practice is one thing, but I think it has to be all or nothing within a conference. Now, could 5 of the 10 FBS conferences decide to play and have a season? Maybe, but I just think it'd be really strange to have not every team in your conference participating. But again, that's just off the top of my head. Haven't thought it through a ton. There's logistical reasons why you should do it and why you shouldn't do it.
And that leads to the biggest question of all, because I hope that this question comes out of all of this, because this is unprecedented. But one thing that Ryan brought up, of just the absolute need of a college football commissioner to help with some of this stuff. And so my hope is that some of the conversations that we're having, some of the conversations that these conferences and schools are having, could lead to that there actually be a college football commissioner that can help govern some of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's been talked about for years for college basketball too. I mean, I think a lot of fans don't really understand, you know, it's the conferences that run it, the conference commissioners and the school presidents that really have all the power. The NCAA doesn't. It's not like the NCAA can say, okay, SEC, you play. You know, NCAA has no power over which conferences play, what schools do. The NCAA is an organization made up of by its member institutions. I think each sport would need its own czar or whatever president, whatever you call. But again, the structure of the sport would have to change too. You can't just say, okay, Willie Donick's in charge of college football, and then him, you know, as a part of the NCAA, they would have to, again, change the whole dynamic of the sport and be sure he has that power. It can't just be he's a figurehead. Because, again, the way it's all structured, that's basically what it would be.
Mitch, good stuff as always. Hey, I think we're getting closer to maybe your daughter and your son saying, man, I think mom and dad are finally going to get out of the house for a little bit. I think that's coming. So you can give them
some good news. We're getting closer to something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, right. You're right. We're getting close to something. We're not sure what, but something. Hey, thanks for doing this. Have a great rest of your day.
All right. Take care, guys.
All right, that is Mitch Light. You can find his work at The Athletic. We will touch on that to wrap up the first hour on the other side. What Chase just brought up there at the end with Mitch, we'll discuss here on Darren Donica Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.